Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves and it's wonderful to have you join me for part three of the four-part program on the life and times of 66-year-old John Arthur Grant. Over the past two programs, we've learned that John was exposed to classical piano at a very young age and showed an immense talent for it. He was, according to his mother and concert piano teacher, destined for a life of being a classical pianist. However, like so many baby boomers, he was swept up in the music revolution of the late 50s and into the 1960s. And despite commencing a formal concert piano and composition study at Melbourne University, he decided it was the new music, the progressive rock music, that was for him. We've listened to his stories of him forming his own bands and connecting with many highly regarded musicians in the 1970s. But if fame was hard to find, money was even harder. This week, John's story moves into the 1980s, where he starts to move away from group membership into freelancing and studio work, although he did form several moderately successful duos. In fact, one of the important lessons he learned was to have multiple projects going, and these included working as a musician in theatre productions, selling keyboards, and becoming a demonstrator for Korg, which saw him travel the world. It was also during this period he began to integrate all his experiences with his love for classical music. We pick up with John talking about the move from being strictly a band member into a more diversified approach to music.
So I left the band, and we now get into about 79, and it's from 79 on that things started to go in different directions, because up until then, most of the time, if you were in a band, 100% of your energy went into that band and you didn't really do anything else. But from 79 onwards, I started to work more as a freelance musician, and meaning, you know, I could doing fill-ins or just work one-off gigs here and there, occasional weddings. I started doing some solo piano work at weddings. I worked as a duo with Leslie Avril for a little while. Yeah, just the two of us, piano and vocal, at places like the upstairs at the Last Laugh mm-hmm. Comedy Cafe and the Flying Trapeze Cafe around in Brunswick Street, and all sorts of other funny little gigs. So I started doing all sorts of things. That's where I started doing some arranging eventually as well.
For other people?
For other people, yeah. I was in the pit. I was a pit musician for a theatre production at the Playbox Theatre for a short season. The musical director was Red Simons. The drummer was Freddie Straux, who did a play, terrible play called The Ripper Show or something. It was with Bruce Spence and Evelyn Crepe. Great actors. It was a great experience, actually, being a theatre pit musician.
But did that pay better than the other gigs you'd been doing?
Oh, it had a 2 week two-week run or something, three-week run. Wasn't an ongoing thing. I remember Red fronting up Graham Blundell, who was the head of the Playbox Theatre at the time, the old Playbox in Exhibition Street before it burnt down. I remember him fronting up. He said, come with me, I'm going in to see Graham Blundell, try and get more money for the band, for rehearsals, you know, and so on. And come with me because, you know, it's the extra sort of moral backup if you're there. And Graham sort of, you know, smilingly, very patiently explained to Red that this was the money that was in the budget and no more could be had. And that was a lesson to me as well, down the track as well. So lots of good musical experiences in those next few years.
Is it appropriate to say to you, it sounds like it would have been a lot of fun though?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I loved it, yeah. doing all sorts of things I've always liked. It sort of keeps you on your toes, can keep you busy, can keep the income coming in if you can do all sorts of different different things. And it's exciting, yes, absolutely. Every few years I found myself doing something different. In that period, late 79-80, I joined up with Wendy Stapleton and another singer called Adrian Campbell, a fantastic voice, and we were, this was just a pub band, this is before Wendy and the Rockets, just doing pub gigs around town, but I have an ongoing relationship with Wendy Stapleton due to that, or do gigs with her sometimes, her and Paul Norton, to this day. Eventually left that band, Aidas Persuaders as it became. We used to work at the grain store and all sorts of pubs and venues around town around 1980. I got back together with Graham Barker, the songwriter that I'd formed the band Palais with a few years earlier, and I ended up living in a share house with Graham for a year or two, and we started writing songs together, and we decided to form a duo, just the two of us,
okay,
with electronic synthesizers, electronic instruments. So we formed a band called Random Sample, later called Dialogue, and I controlled the drum machine. I played bass synth with one hand and synth with the other hand, and Graham also had a synthesizer, and he played synth and did lead vocals. And we wrote together. Graham wrote a lot. He's an amazing songwriter, as I said. Also an amazing visual artist, but that's another story. Very talented. And we tried to make a go of it as an original duo. And we gave it a try for a couple of years. We had some interest from Festival Records. Mark Moffat was an in-house producer at the time. We went up to Sydney and did some recording, but sadly, nothing came of that either. So
I hope if there's any young people listening to this show who've got the stars in their eyes, they begin to understand that it is a rocky, rocky, long road. It's not paved with gold or even silver.
It's not paved with bronze or even alfoil.
Well said.
Necessarily. I haven't made a lot of money in my life. I've done okay. Surprisingly, things do get better from here on in.
Well, what is it that brought about this change then? When did this, not necessarily the moment in the day, but what created this situation where you were able to make a comfortable living out of your music?
Well, one thing happened in this period in December 1980. In this period also, I'd started, in the Phil Manning band, I'd started writing keyboard reviews and doing interviews for Jam Magazine. Jam Magazine, spelled J-A-M-M, Journal of Australian Music and Musicians.
I remember that, mate.
Yeah. In the late 70s, perhaps in through the early 80s. I'd met the editor at a Phil Manning band gig, and he asked me, out of the blue, because he needed a keyboard player to review new keyboards. And I found myself thrown into that situation of going to a music store or getting a synthesizer from a music store and writing an article about it. Something which, you know, I'd done okay at English in high school. I actually had the ability to do that, but the editor of Jam, he had no idea that I may have had that ability. He just said, "Hey, would you like to do this?" Okay, yeah. So I started doing it.
Yep.
And that led to interviewing some keyboard players. I interviewed Sam McNally, who from Stylus, who was in the John Farnham band at the time. I interviewed Murray Burns from My Sex, interviewed Eddie Rayner from Split Enz, of course, and became friends with a couple of those people. So that was a situation where, in order to review keyboards, I had to keep an eye on what was going on around music stores, if any new synths were going on. I went into Brash's one day, and the manager there said, "Hey, what are you doing during the day? Would you like to... how about you working in the store?" which my first reaction was no.
Selling music instruments,
selling well, keyboards, even synthesizers, even that. No, I'm not gonna do that. That would mean not doing music full time.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories.
This is a special Baby Boomers edition.
However, I'd started writing songs with Graham Barker. We decided we wanted to form a duo, Random Sample. And I didn't know how we were going to do it because I was working with Wendy Stapleton and band, or what it had become. I thought, if I leave that, I'll have no income, apart from a few other sporadic things. Yeah. And, you know, we've got an original band that we've got to try and build up doing little gigs around town. How am I going to do it? I suddenly thought, when this opportunity came up, I can do this day gig for a little while, leave the nighttime band and concentrate on Random Sample.
Yes.
And build that up. So that's what I did. I applied for the job and got it, and started working in a musical instrument store selling synthesizers, mainly synthesizers and electronic gear. That was a big turning point. It was a huge turning point in income. I'd made more money than I'd ever made before in my life, and it opened up other possibilities for me. I didn't want to stay working in retail, and I didn't. I stayed full-time for 18 months, two years, and then got an offer from the distributor of Korg musical instruments, Korg synthesizers, distributed by Billy Hyde Music at the time, later called Music Link. And Ivor McGuffin, the manager, major shareholder, along with Gary Hyde, said, why don't you demonstrate some synthesizers. So I started demonstrating Korg instruments. I continued being a product specialist for Korg for 29 years after that.
Wow.
Up until about 2012 or 13. It was never a full-time job. I was a contractor for them, but it was like a bell curve. I started off very, very sporadically doing bits and pieces. I got very involved with them for a little while in the 90s, and then it gradually faded away because I didn't want to do that full-time either. Never did, but it did become a major source of income, became a major way that I could still stay involved in music. It was part of a broader music industry, and it was part of it was teaching, which is something I had done a little bit of before.
Now, somebody like myself who would find themselves in that situation would find most of my paycheck going back into buying the equipment I'm looking at every day and working with. Were you able to resist that temptation, or did you end up spending a fair bit of money you were earning on buying the equipment around you?
While I was working at Brash's, I did buy some equipment, yeah. I bought quite a bit. Working for Korg, it was a different situation because they had to basically give me products when they first arrived in the country to get to know how to use.
Right.
And to demonstrate around the country, as I did. I went interstate, you know, sometimes five or six times a year.
So the equipment basically followed you home?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, eventually, if I wanted to keep it, I had to pay for it, but at way below retail prices.
Yes.
So if you look around, you will see that most of the keyboards here are still Korg keyboards, even though they're much newer than those ones back in the 80s and 90s that I was dealing with. But I went to Korg. I went to Japan a few times, and I went to trade shows sometimes twice a year, usually once a year, either Frankfurt or Los Angeles.
That would have been exciting.
Yes, it was, and I didn't demonstrate at those places, but
to see everything, and it was paid.
Yes, yeah, yeah, well, yeah. That was part of the role. They had to pay for me to go over there, and we had meetings with Korg and products planning meetings, and I did a little bit of sound design for Korg along the way. Eventually, it led to in the noughties to my doing demonstrations around Asia for Korg, as well as Australia. I did some in New Zealand. I went to Singapore, to China about 3 or 4 times, to Korea a couple of times, to India a couple of times, Indonesia I went to, and also to Iran. Tehran. I went to Tehran twice doing demonstrations for Korg synthesizers.
I'm somewhat speechless at that little bit of information, and that doesn't happen very often. If you'd asked me 2 or 3 places where I would have that would never have been involved with electronic music or synthesizers, I think Iran would have been in that list. Why was Iran involved in electronic music? I mean, well, it's a fairly religiously tight country, isn't it? With
yeah. Not quite as tight Western as you decadence. Might, well, it's tight politically, but lovely people. They're like people everywhere.
Not as often the system that's not the people,
that's right.
Yes.
That's right. So they're heavily involved, not with what's called the Ranger keyboards, which are keyboards that have automatic accompaniment built in. Over the last 20 years, there's some very professional keyboards that do that sort of thing, and they're very commonly used in parts of Europe as well. By solo acts, duos,
clubs, smaller things, acts,
clubs, weddings, that sort of thing. That's the type of thing they're mainly selling over there.
So there's an irony in this part of the story that you became an international traveller through music, but not through being a musician, but rather through being almost a musical technician.
Yes, but you had to play music, though.
Yes, but it wasn't your music, was it?
It sometimes was.
It was. I
sneaked in some of my own things occasionally, but yes, you usually had to play things that people recognised. But there's also always some improvising involved in those situations, and improvising is something I've always done since I first started playing in bands back in the late 60s. That's along with playing in bands, that's the other constant in my life, has been improvisation, the ability to make something up on the spot, or to make something up that goes along with whatever else is
playing.
Some
of us would say that's probably the most the pinnacle of creativity is through improvisation more than through the structured piece of music, isn't it?
Yes, and jazz players would say that, and I'm not a jazz player.
No, neither am I.
Never have been, but yes, it is one of the pinnacles of and the way that a lot of music is composed. And the way that a lot of my music is composed and the way a lot of it would have been in the past by a lot of the famous composers that started off as improvisation.
Yes, yes.
So there's a lot of improvisation involved in showing people around keyboards and synthesizers. Yeah.
You're now being exposed to a lot of cultures and a lot of countries. Is it a difficult or impossible question to ask you? Did that leave you to having a favourite country or a favourite place?
Oh, look, quite possibly Iran.
Iran, again.
Just because it's so different. I didn't like India. I never want to go back to India. Although, again, I met some lovely people and really, really liked the experience.
So we've managed to skirt very cleverly in your story so far around a whole range of elements of you and music, but not quite so much going back to tying it into the early years of the classical part. And yet, when you look at your biography and look at your website and look at the things you've done, your compositional work of recent years is anything but what we might call popular music in terms of what's played on radio. So
that's right.
Can you pull this into us? When did this start happening for you in a big way, and where is it going for you?
I think it's always been there. I think that it's been submerged by all the other things that have happened to me and that I've chosen to take on.
When were you able, though, to actually dedicate yourself to that rather than having it on the peripheral?
Only 5 or 6 years ago, when other work started to fall away.
Okay.
I've made attempts in the past, I suppose, but it's only when, as I've gradually moved into semi-retirement, that I've really had the time to develop it.
Has this happened for personal growth and appreciation, or is there a commercial aspect to it for you?
No, it's all personal. It's things that I want to do. I don't expect it to make money.
Right. Well, I think you've grown a bit of a wise head for that one over the years. Do you do any live performances with it? Or is it really is just for you?
It's been performed.
Okay.
By other people.
Well, please enlighten us. When did this happen? Who's done it? How is it happening?
I wrote a piece for the Astra Choir. Astra is a choir I've been following for many years. They put on concerts, directed by John McCackie, put on concerts of very divergent material. Music usually in the Western classical tradition, but within the one concert there might be a 14th century medieval piece and a piece written this year and several others in the middle, and they'll all have a theme. I wrote a piece for the Astra Choir and they performed it.
Right.
I subsequently set it to the Australian Voices, which is another choir based in Brisbane, and they performed one of the three pieces as well.
Must have been very gratifying to
yes.
you.
Yes, it was great. And giving voice to, as I said, things in the Western classical tradition that I hadn't really allowed myself to explore fully since my university days or since my progressive rock days. I do use elements of rock music in those classical pieces. I use I like to use rhythms and riffs that may have come from my time as a rock-based musician, but they're put into a classical music container, if you like, and they're developed in the way that classical music might be developed. So I wrote some pieces for solo bassoon. Can you believe I wrote a piece for solo flute, and I wrote a piece for flute ensemble, Monash University Flute Ensemble. Directed by Peter Sheridan, performed that, and he performed the solo flute piece.
Join John and I next week for the final part of his story, which includes the development of his classical approach to music, while maintaining a love for contemporary playing as well. He shares his thoughts on a range of social issues. That's next week, the final part of the life and times of John Arthur Grant on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.